And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Hey, well, hey, good afternoon, everybody, one and all. Welcome to August 20th. Where is the month of August gone? I don't know. It's, you know, another full week and then some, and then we're going to be back. We're going to be in September. So it's just like, wow. And all the kids I've been talking to and counseling along the way, it's like they are not ready to go back. They want to squeeze as much summer out of the year as possible, or as much summer out of the month of August anyway. But they're, you know, slowly warming up to the idea. And, you know, the more they go back to school shopping and so forth and used to the idea of, yes, you'll go back in person. Yes, you'll probably have to wear a mask. And, you know, they're excited because they learn best while they're in the classroom. So it's just something over the last year. It's very hard for many kids to learn through the internet for long periods of time, as well as for us adults. You know, there has to be, you know, highly motivated individuals to be able to take classes online or to be able to, you know, take full courses and things like that, you know, let alone, you know, just one class here and there. So, but it can be done, but, you know, hopefully they will catch the back to school bug here soon and they will be ready. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in this afternoon. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. There we go. I'll get it right here. To visit the website, it's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. All one word there. So bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And just in case you're not able to stick around for the full hour and listen to this broadcast live, you can go back and listen again. You can go back into our archives because these broadcasts are now podcasted. And you can also go and if you want to, just go down through the list of previous shows and you can listen to them at your leisure. So on that note, I wanted to just thank everybody for their support over the past year, and I just wanted to mention that you now have the opportunity to continue your support by becoming a monthly subscriber. Now, this subscription is not required to listen to my talk shows, but it is greatly appreciated. So again, you just go to the website and you'll see the link on top of the website itself, and choose any amount that you feel comfortable giving, no pressure. So I thank you for that in advance. Well, I am very excited to be with you here today, each and every Friday afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, and any other time in between. And each and every week, these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And if you would like to call in and be part of the show today, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. Well, for those of you who are tuning in for the very first time, I just wanted to say welcome to the show. I always appreciate new listeners. And just in case you're wondering what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about, it's this. Reclaiming Authenticity focuses on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, and it's all placed within the context of our relationships with ourselves and others and God or the divine. And for those of you who are new to the program, I would just like to share with you just a basic personal and professional philosophy of just how I see working with individuals, because I am a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need for this life. From the moment we're born, and even then some, we already come in gifted. And we have our gifts, our skills, our talents, our strengths, character traits, and so forth. But sometimes we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel that we need to hide that giftedness just for the sake of wanting somebody else to feel comfortable around us. Or we may push our giftedness or our skills or talents and so forth way, way down inside of us so that others cannot see it, because perhaps those gifts were exploited at one point. Or even perhaps when we were younger, we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. But that is just simply not true. But whenever we take on those messages and we internalize those messages, we don't realize our giftedness, our strengths, the very best parts of ourselves and who we are. And we often go through life functioning from a place of woundedness or victimhood instead of a place of healing and wholeness and embracing our hachetas, or our uniqueness. And the whole reason why I place this integration of mental health and spirituality back in relationships is because, you know, one of life's greatest ironies is this, that we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in relationships. And yet, and here's the irony, we can discover our greatest healing, our strength, our peace, forgiveness, and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships just might be within our own families. They might be amongst our coworkers, colleagues, and friends. But whenever we work on ourselves, whenever we are able to transform and to allow the very best parts of ourselves to come out and to discover truly who we are as soul, whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence, grace, and understanding. It may not be obvious at first, but on some level and to some degree, that transformation shows up in others. However, forgiveness, kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we find that we can be compassionate with ourselves, we can then be compassionate with others. And whenever we are more forgiving of ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves and everything that has brought us to this very moment, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. But all in all, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. So how is your heart today? Excuse me. I hope it is well, and I hope you are well. I hope that if you are even struggling today at some point or some level, that you will find the rest, the peace, and the comfort that you need. Well, welcome to today's show entitled, You're Not Lazy, Crazy, or Stupid. You know, and transforming the psycho-spiritual effects of these labels. So let's just start off with a question. How do we raise the vibrational energy of, let's say, lower dimensional attitudes and perspectives? And, you know, while we're at it, just let's throw in also the pervasive negative attitudes that still exist today. How do we change all that? How do we transform all that into higher levels of dimension where forgiveness, gratitude, and love are not only meant to be embraced in our lives, but also we can live out forgiveness, gratitude, and love. We can live out these things on a daily basis. Well, how many out there in internet radio land remember as a child ever being read a story before going to sleep? Okay. You know, there you are in your bed and you got your little blankie or, you know, a teddy bear or something. Okay. And mom or dad or somebody was reading you, you know, a bedtime story. And perhaps, you know, you were read the story of Hansel or Gretel or Rumpelstiltskin or the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Or what about the King of the Golden Mountain or the Frog Prince or Cinderella? Or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, I have to say, you know, these stories that we were read as children, you know, they were cleaned up, as it were, from their original R-rated versions of long ago. You know, these well-known stories came from the Brothers Grimm, and they lived during a time that, you know, they told these stories. You know, that often involved a lot of violence, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of cruelty to women and children, and included things like wicked witches and all sorts of vile characters. But if you have ever seen the movie Frozen, which is a classic, and there, yes, Frozen 2, and if you have small kids or grandkids, you know all the songs and all the tunes, but I'm not going to hum any because then you'll get that stuck in your head. But anyway, if you've ever seen the movie Frozen, then perhaps you're aware that the movie is a variation not of the Brothers Grimm, but of Hans Christian Andersen's children's story, The Snow Queen. And Andersen, he wrote this story back around 1845. And the story goes like this. You know, there is a evil troll, that which is, you know, a.k.a. the devil. And he uses a very large magic mirror, kind of like those funhouse mirrors at carnivals. He uses this mirror to distort the appearance of everything that it reflects. In fact, this mirror wasn't designed to reflect, you know, say, the wholesome and beautiful aspects of people and things, but instead magnified only their ugly and wicked characteristics. Now, throughout the story, this troll, that is AKA the devil, he becomes amused in distorting the images of everyone and everything to the degree that even the most beautiful lands looked like boiled spinach. Something totally unappetizing, okay? Very horrific. Well, one day this troll decides, with the help of his minions, to carry the mirror into heaven so that he thinks he might make fools of the angels and God. However, the mirror slips from their grasp and falls back to earth, shattering into billions of pieces. And these tiny shards of mirror are then blown by the wind all over the earth, which eventually get into the people's eyes and hearts. And as a result, people's hearts become frozen like ice, and now their eyes can only see the ugliness and evil in each other and the world in which they live. Okay. Well, ironically, our past wounds are just like the shards of distorted perceptions of who we truly are as souls, as well as what are those things that really freeze our hearts from seeing the beauty and goodness in ourselves and others. I mean, for the people who struggle with intergenerational wounds, who have suffered crimes against humanity, society has often held up its own mirrors of misleading standards, sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally. But the distortion is still there. And nevertheless, the shards of illusion are intentionally designed to add generational distortion to the eyes and hearts of the weak and the wounded. And over time, then, within our minds, you know, our minds tell us that what we perceive, albeit limited and hazy, must be true. In severe cases, you know, trauma can be passed down genetically, and it does attach itself to our DNA. and often in a very covert way disguises itself as harmful physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual symptoms. And similarly, as intergenerational trauma is passed down through societies and families, that is, what we carry in our genes and how we are or how we were raised and so forth, various social systems also galvanized harmful stereotypes and prejudices, and injustices, emotional dependence, biases, and so on. And therefore, you know, intergenerational trauma is not just limited to how it affects our families, but it also affects all relationships, from the most intimate ones to just mere acquaintances. And so it's very easy for people to go through life and, you know, if they've ever heard themselves being described as lazy, crazy, and stupid, it doesn't take too long for people to believe that it's true. And ironically, the earliest that we, you know, can battle with shame in our lives is somewhere between 2 and 4 years old. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are babies at that point. 2 to 4 years old. We're toddlers. We're running around. We're still babies. Okay. But we are like little sponges. We're listening to things. We're watching. We're learning. We're trying to imitate as best we can as we try to navigate our little world by paying attention to those around us. But these messages that, you know, we have been told perhaps as being lazy, crazy, stupid, backward, shy, or whatever it was, you know, we don't know any better. And so we assume that, well, if it's coming from an adult, coming from a parent, coming from a caregiver, there must be something wrong with me. And once we do that, we have just internalized shame. We have internalized those messages. And now we begin the battle of trying to rid ourselves from that shame. Well, we might, you know, just be fascinated with, you know, everything around us at that particular time in our lives. But the whole reason that, you know, it's very devastating and intergenerational trauma is so devastating for us is because trauma in general places a distorted template over our perceptions. I mean, trauma basically says to us, that's all there is. This is all there is to you. And this is as good as it gets. You know, we don't know of anything better. We don't even think that there is something better until, you know, we are shown that there is something better. And yet, you know, with intergenerational trauma for those who are wounded, passing down such labels, you know, all lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as a soul. In fact, once we embrace ourselves as a soul, we are going to be even more astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but also to empower others to do the same. Okay, but, you know, if you are a lover of history like I am, you know, all you have to do is just go back in time. And as history has taught us, many people have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul. And therefore, they've tried to silence its cry. And if you've been listening to me for some time now, you know that, you know, one of the things that I typically say on this broadcast is that there's no way that anybody can silence another person's soul, because the soul is powerful. The soul is eternal, and you cannot silence its cry. And through killings and murders or genocide, starvations, forced assimilations, humiliations, degradations, looking at people as savages, looking at them as primitive and backward and unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable, as those in control see fit. I mean, what is really heartbreaking to me is that these atrocities on down through history have often been committed in the name of God by people who should see themselves as soul. In fact, even when killing is done in the name of advancing the kingdom of God, really, when we get right down to it, the only thing that is truly advanced is this distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. Now, I have to say that I have yet to meet anybody who begins a journey of self-discovery, that sooner or later they have to work through personal and family traumatic experiences, as well as, you know, re-examine the stories that have been handed down to them by those also needing to come to terms with their own trauma. And in a sense, the family perspectives and these stories and so forth and interpretations of traumatic events seem to go hand in hand. In fact, sometimes trauma becomes a way in which individuals and families and generations have defined themselves, which internally then perpetuates this cycle of intergenerational trauma. And let me put it this way. If grandparents or great-grandparents, parents and or other caregivers do not have a healthy sense of themselves, or they too are struggling with intergenerational traumatic experiences, they're going to unconsciously pass their issues on to younger generations in terms of their fears and anxieties and insecurities and abandonment, just to name a few. But for the most part, healing is a matter of unlearning these generational lessons that have affected what family members have believed about themselves, as well as how these perceptions have affected their behaviors towards one another. It's not impossible. It is very possible to heal from this. It is a process, but it is possible. And even if one's parents or grandparents or great-grandparents are deceased, healing can still be achieved by understanding the certain dynamics or the nuances of trauma that has been handed down in the family, as well as appreciating the resiliency and other character traits that family members possess. You see, emotional and psychological wounds are not the only things that we may have inherited. You know, our character strengths, our gifts, our skills were also handed down. And that's one of the joys that I have in just working with kids is that, like, if they have a particular skill or a talent, like, say, for, like, love of music, or they just have this gift where they can pick up pretty much any instrument and just start playing, my next question is, who else in the family can do that? You know, was your grandmother a great singer, or was your grandfather a musician? You know, where were things passed down? Not just unhealthy, wounded stuff in the family. Okay, so not just trauma is handed down or has the potential of being handed down, but also the other great quality characteristics, the gifts and the skills and so forth. And this realization of such, you know, phenomenon is a significant aspect of healing relationships. I mean, it occurs when we can understand what has so wounded another person and what has so wounded ourselves as to allow us to continually act out of our woundedness, but yet expect different results. And I have to say that from my own personal experience, that by understanding the background of those who hurt me, it has allowed me to take the necessary steps closer to forgiving and releasing the burdens of carrying around my wounds any longer. Because I started to see that's where their wounds came from. They were not born that way. They didn't come in the world totally evil. you know, what happened in their lives that may have taken them down that road? What wounds are they still struggling with? Where do they still need to be healed, and so forth? And the same is true whenever we forgive one another. You know, in a sense, what we are doing is we're telling the other person that we no longer want them to carry the weight of their wounds. We want them to also be unburdened by, let's say, any weight of bitterness or unforgiveness or shame or humiliation or whatever other pain they may have suffered from in the past that continues to influence how they think and say and act in harmful ways today. But let's take this point a little bit deeper, shall we? Okay, what happens, shall we say, if we go to ask, you know, for forgiveness and the person or people spit it back in our face? What do we do then? I mean, we're ready to forgive or ready to be forgiven, but the other person is not. Does this mean that true forgiveness cannot occur? No. I mean, we can still release ourselves from carrying any psychological, emotional, and spiritual pain that we are holding onto. And we can shift this negative energy that we've been giving to those things into more life-giving, positive, higher vibrational, healthier relationships. And so I, you know, you've heard me talk about this before, about self-inflicted wounds. And, you know, this is exactly where I got this phrase from. It's like the vibration, you know, of an echo. That the negative energy, you know, of whatever has hurt us or where we are, that negative energy of what we send out through our thoughts or our words or our actions will return to us. Just like we hear our voice echoing back in our ears whenever we're in a tunnel, okay, or if we're in a cave. And this energy, unless we transform that energy through healing our own wounds, it will come back to us exactly how it went out from us. Okay, think about it. Were you ever a kid that just shouted, hello, in a cave? And it comes back to us, hello, just like we sent it out. The same is true with our negative energy, our negative thoughts, our words, and our actions. How we send things out is how it's going to return to us. What we send out is going to return to us in the same way. And this is something that we have to be mindful with all the time. And this understanding has a profound impact on our understanding for beginning that healing process and forgiving ourselves and one another. And really, it's based on a larger model of restorative justice. And that's an interesting study to do in and of itself, just how has history and where history has shown that restorative justice works. Well, a great book to read this summer, even though we have, what, a little over a month and a day before the official summer is over and we come into autumn. But a great book to read, whether it's summer, autumn, any other time, you know, is The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. The Wounded Healer. And in that book, Nouwen states that about almost 74% people are often compelled to go into helping professions because they also understand themselves as being wounded. They know what it's like. They've felt the pain. They've been hurt. They know the struggle, and so on and so forth. And they want to reach out to others who have also been wounded. But I want to take this one step further, take a little bit deeper here, and say that people not only see themselves as having been wounded, but they also know the power of transformative healing and the power of forgiveness and the power of working through all that stuff and pain that takes place in themselves, as well as its effects on the rest of humanity. And the key is embracing who we truly are and not allowing ourselves to fall back or even be pulled back into victimhood. And ironically, when we find our voice, whenever we find our peace, whenever we find our true self, there will be others who become uncomfortable around us. Because now the light we carry, it just might be too much for them to be around. And it has nothing to do with being inferior or superior. It's just because the energy is so great. The light is so great. And yet, on the other hand, there will be others who will be drawn to this light because they resonate with the higher vibrational aspects of that energy that comes from the light. Well, I would really love to hear what's on your heart and mind about this subject. So again, if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. After that short break, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And before I go any further, I just want to share with you about next week's show. I'm very excited about this one. So tune in next Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, when I will continue a conversation on quenching the soul with the light of water. Yeah, that's right. You heard correctly. Quenching the soul with the light, L-I-G-H-T, of water. And water is something that hopefully we don't take for granted because it's one of our most precious resources, but so is light. And what happens when we understand the concept of how water holds the light and how that nourishes our soul? So tune in next Friday, as I will be exploring and talking about quenching the soul with the light of water. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about how, distorted family perspectives and interpretations of traumatic events seem to go hand in hand. In fact, sometimes trauma becomes a way in which individuals and families and generations have defined themselves, which then perpetuates this cycle of intergenerational trauma. And this is something that, you know, in working with kids on or teenagers, they kind of start to put two and two together. They start to connect the dots on this because, you know, they understand, you know, how things have been handed down through the generations. And if they're sitting with me, it means that they're struggling with the same kind of trauma, but did not go through the initial horrific experience that caused the trauma in the first place. So anyway, when these kids, these teenagers, start to connect the dots, kind of a light bulb goes off in their heads, and they just say, now, wait a minute. If this stuff happened, you know, with my grandparents or great-grandparents or however far back I can go, why is it landing on me? Like, why do I have to be the one to deal with this stuff? How come they couldn't deal with it? How come they couldn't stop this? Why did they keep getting handed down? And at that point, I know that they're starting to get it. And most of the time, I have to smile because it's a joy-filled, like, aha moment. Because then I share with them, the reason why you're dealing with this is because you're actually the strongest one in the family to be able to stop this. You're the strongest one who can transform this. You're the one that, let's say, your grandparents might be looking to now in order to heal the family. And you're the one to keep this from going forward so that your kids and grandkids and great, 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 whatever kids into the future don't have to deal with this. And that word of encouragement or that power, these kids really take into their hearts and they, you know, get a smile on their face. And, you know, that shifts this mentality already of, or this perspective of, I've been called lazy, crazy, and stupid all my life to, oh yeah, I am the strongest one in the family. I can deal with this stuff. I can take care of this. You know, let's go. You know, where do we start? You know, and it's like, easy, kid, easy. You know, got a lot of work to do. But yes, you are the strongest one in the family. Okay. Because perhaps in their realization of what it is that they've had to deal with over their lives, perhaps they've also were the ones that came into the, you know, this world with the strengths, the talents, the gifts, the, you know, and so forth, the character traits and all that, to be able to heal the family and transform this negative energy into something higher, you know, the vibrational energy that just raises the family's energy very high. Okay, so interestingly, you know, it's just wonderful to work with kids who just get this. How do we heal intergenerational trauma? Because, you know, in all reality, you know, if, you know, great grandparents or parents or other caregivers, they didn't have a healthy sense of who they are, or they, you know, were struggling with some their own intergenerational traumatic experiences, and they were not strong enough to find the healing, you know. And again, this isn't a shame or guilt issue. It's not a matter of pointing fingers and say, well, he must be super weak because they couldn't stop this. On the contrary, you know, it's not a blame. It's not a fault finding. It's just maybe they were just unconsciously aware of how they were being affected by such trauma. And then they also unconsciously passed on these issues to the younger generations, you know, and just really projected their own fears and anxieties and insecurities and abandonment issues and so forth. Now, admittedly, looking to others for approval and self-worth appears to be a natural part of developing a sense of who we are. And right before the break, I was sharing that, you know, at a very early age, around 2, 3, maybe even 4 years old, I mean, we're still babies at that point. At that age, we are so susceptible to start to internalize very shame-filled messages. And it's one thing, you know, that if, you know, even today, let's say somebody says, hey, you're lazy, crazy, and stupid. You're never going to amount to anything. And we laugh that off or just like, yeah, okay, whatever, go away. You know, it's not landing a shame in us. But the minute we stop and we listen to those messages of you're lazy, crazy, and stupid, and we start to internalize it, and we start to entertain those messages, or we start to see patterns of like, oh yeah, that didn't work out, I guess that other person was right that I am lazy, and if, you know, because of this happened, oh gosh, I must really be stupid then. But however these messages or these labels are reinforced in just a very hurtful way, they land in us as shame. And it really affects our self-worth and how we not only see ourselves, but also how we interact with others, how we see the world. And it's going to affect our actions as to whether or not we feel confident enough at some point to take chances in life or to take risks. Or are they, you know, those messages going to immobilize us so much to the degree that we cannot, you know, step outside of a very boxed in comfort zone. Okay. So, you know, looking to the approval, you know, for others, you know, to get our self-worth, it is a natural part. Okay. You know, we haven't learned to internalize it for ourselves yet. And this behavior is often how we first learn about ourselves and others and the world. And, you know, we have families, we have teachers as we get a little older, and we have other early childhood authority figures, you know, whoever they are in our lives. And, you know, these figures reflect their own views and mirror these perceptions back to us. So again, we can go back and rope in, the movie Frozen, or actually the Snow Queen, you know, from Hans Christian Andersen. And, they mirror these perceptions back to us. For example, long before we could even form words, okay, we are very skilled at reading facial prompts or sensing another person's approval or disapproval, or we recognize the tones of love and laughter and anger and contempt and distinguishing between a loving touch or a cold detachment and learning every other emotion in between. Okay, because sometime around 3 months of age, again, early on, we begin to engage in what's called face-to-face interactions with our caregivers. It's social referencing is what it's called. And as infants, we display visual, facial, and vocal behaviors in response to how we are being treated. And it's through a kind of give-and-take exchange between ourselves and others. You know, typically, it helps us to understand different situations. You know, we realize that it's like, hey, you know, in church, you sit there and be quiet. You don't want to jump up and like start shouting and screaming as if you were, you know, at a baseball game or whatever. Okay. But fairly early on, you know, like I said, well before we can even start to form words, you know, we're picking up facial tones from others. And as a result, because we have yet to form words and to yet to even express a language, it's then we hold these initial interactions in our bodies as we develop a sense of trust and safety, or we develop a sense of suspicion and distrust. And yet, from these early stages of infancy, we learn to regulate our affect as we took our social cues from the people around us, you know, how and when to express our feelings appropriately, or as well as like when and where such emotions are to be displayed, you know, like at work or play or school or family get-togethers or funerals or whatever. And as we, you know, are physically and emotionally maturing, we learn to become less dependent on others for this kind of affirmation, but it is replaced with a more internalized or an individual sense of who we are. In other words, instead of looking externally to get what we need in terms of approval and acceptance, we now look within to find such qualities. You know, qualities like resiliency, you know, peace and self-love, etc. But how do we do this? You know, what needs to be done? You know, how do we work through, let's say, the wounds of shame? You know, and this is very difficult. You know, it seems to be easier for people to work through issues of guilt rather than issues of shame. I mean, at least with guilt, you know, there's some sense of responsibility or taking ownership of it, and then going back and apologizing and making amends. You know, there's something that guilt requires up from us. You know, we have to do something. Shame is different. You know, shame has to do more with a distorted identity. It has to do more with a distorted perception of, you know, this isn't who we truly are, but we've taken it on as something hurtful and shameful. But how do we get out from under this? Well, we start by looking at the issues squarely for what they are, as well as where and from whom did they come from. Okay, so we can start by just saying, you know, where have I been hurt the most? You know, who has hurt me the most? Where in my life, even today, do I struggle to find forgiveness, you know, for myself, or, you know, where do I struggle to find forgiveness in others? And here's the second half of this. It's like, where do we find it difficult to release in our lives? Because in some ways it serves a dysfunctional space in us. You know, it's one thing to say, yes, I forgive you, or thank you for forgiving me. But we got to let that go then. We have to release it. We have to, it goes out from us. You know, because I've met too many of people who are tempted to pick it back up again and carry it around and like, oh, I've never been forgiven of this, because they've never also released it. Okay, so forgive and then release it. And when we experience forgiveness and when we're able to release this negative energy and the pain that we've been hanging on to, you know, those aspects of ourselves that no longer serve us, we do tune into those higher frequencies, or, you know, vibrations, spiritual vibrations, as it were. And I love the analogy of a music tuner, or like a piano tuner, I should say, using a tuning fork by first striking the prongs and then thereby releasing a perfect wave pattern. And then that person adjusts the sound of an instrument so that the two vibrations are in sync. And that is a great visual to what it means to raise our vibrational awareness. You know, the vibrations, the higher vibrations are already there, but it's what has to be released in our lives, or what has to be forgiven, or what has to go, or what, you know, recognizing things that no longer serve us that allow us then to tune ourselves to that higher vibration, that things that our soul just really resonate with, because the two vibrations are in sync. And we also have to keep in mind that just as we initially look to others for our sense of affirmation and belonging and acceptance, so too are others looking to us to receive, you know, their sense of affirmation, belonging, and acceptance. I mean, at first glance, this exchange appears to be mutually beneficial. However, it can also lead to codependency in our relationships, okay, which is typically seen in an unhealthy relationship whereby one person, shall we say, supports or enables another person's addiction, or supports their poor mental health or immaturity or irresponsibility, insecurity or underachievement, just to name a few. And perhaps the most common theme in codependency is this excessive reliance on others for one's approval and a sense of identity. And it really becomes dysfunctional because we can't allow that other person to change in healthy ways because, well, if they changed, I can't get my unhealthy needs met. So we need to keep them just as dysfunctional as us in order to keep getting from each other what we think we need. Okay. So, you know, it takes time to heal from these things, but, you know, it also begins with an awareness. And healing is also a matter of unlearning these generational lessons that have affected what family members have believed about themselves for so long. Okay. And just want to share with you just wonderful story that I had actually reacquainted myself with here in the few minutes that we have. I once read a story that in certain African tribes, when someone did something wrong, they take the person to the center of the village, you know, where the tribe surrounds him. And for two days, they say nothing to him except all the good he has done. See, the tribe believes each person is good, but sometimes people make mistakes, which they interpret as being a cry for help. And everyone in that community unites as a people and as one voice to help this person reconnect with their good nature. And this is what they call Ubuntu. And just imagine if we did that today, you know, if somebody had, you know, whether it be a community or a town or something, where people know the person and they get into trouble somehow, some way. And instead of lashing out, instead of, you know, being hostile toward the person or turning your back on them, we bring them into, let's say, the circle. And we remind him or her all of the good that they have done and how every person sees them in a very positive way. Just, what if we did that today? What would that look like then? What would be the end result? I mean, just imagine, instead of burdening someone, and by the way, we're going to burden ourselves too, with such labels as you're lazy, crazy, or stupid, we remind that person of everything good they have done, including the fact that they need to be reminded of the need for themselves to go deeper into themselves in order to find the light that has always been there. They just don't know it yet. Now, if we humans are capable of not only seeing, but also saying life-giving affirmations to one another, imagine how God sees us. I mean, just imagine, what would God say, you know, for 2 days if God was part of that circle and we were in the center? Just imagine it. If we can come up with very positive affirmations and we can remind the person just how much they are loved and cared for and all the goodness that's within them, what else would God add to that? What would God say to us? Well, another story is just a little different that you know, I often listen to people debate about the opioid crisis and what needs to be done to eradicate it. And in all of the discussions of how to solve this problem, you know, through better education or throwing more money at rehab programs or building bigger prisons, I have yet to find anybody to ask the question, what kind of pain are these people in that they do not want to feel? What kind of pain are these people in that they don't want to feel? What kind of physical pain are they in? What kind of emotional pain are they in? What kind of psychological pain are they in? And in fact, what kind of spiritual pain are they in? So let's return to this African practice of Ubuntu. And another definition of Ubuntu I heard is it's, you know, a Southern African philosophy that actually came from the Guinea culture that roughly means I am because we are. And it signifies this interconnection of all of humanity. And in the story that I read, a South African student explains Ubuntu like this. He says, Ubuntu means seeing humanity in all. We are all one. Your fate is my fate. We are all siblings. Try to think of yourself not as an isolated individual, but as a drop in the ocean of humanity, a single entity. Ubuntu means kindness, humanness, hospitality to all. Ubuntu means that we must lift all of us collectively. So why do we see the concerns of the marginalized and suffering and think, at least I'm not one of them? Or see someone of a different race or culture or class and think that, you know, their issues really don't matter to us? Why do we see ourselves as separate? Well, according to Ubuntu, are they not our siblings? Are we not them and they not us? Well, no, you are not lazy, crazy, or stupid. You are beautiful. You are loved. You have gifts and talents and skills and so forth. You have all the wonderful, wonderful things, you know, not to go out and kill others, not to be filled with hatred or self-loathing. You're a soul that has come from a vast universe filled with the presence of God, and you will return there. No, you are not lazy, crazy, or stupid, for this is not how God sees you. Never has, never will. Perhaps you've just never realized it yet. Because we try to make ourselves worthy of God's grace and love, but we don't realize that unconditional love has always been with us. The only thing that separates us from God is our unawareness of God's unconditional love. And where there is unconditional love, there's unconditional forgiveness and peace, just waiting to shower us with a love which we have never known or experienced. And it's time for people everywhere to believe this, to trust it, and to walk in this truth, to see it in themselves and to see it in others. And when we forgive, you know, not if, but when, let us do so from the perspective that the other person has yet to realize their fullness, you know, in God. And we need to forgive ourselves when we have forgotten our truth. Yes, the truth sets us free, but freedom is often an intimidating aspect for us to grasp. Most of the time, we embrace negativity and love to be controlled by people who want us to be something that suits them and that suits their unrealized truth. And I've sat with many children who often struggle with low to no self-esteem, all because they've picked up messages that they've heard from parents, teachers, or other authority figures in their lives. But I'll leave you today with one simple sentence for, you know, in the words of Gandhi. If you want real peace in the world, start with children. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I invite you to join me next week as we take a look at quenching the soul with the light of water. Until then, be safe. By all means, behave yourselves, and may you be blessed with the light of God. Take care.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.